The new Starz series, Marianne George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but it shockingly is. With nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. This show is full of wit, scandal, action. You will not be able to look away. I know, because I couldn't. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Set sail and save right away when you book your next Disney cruise vacation with UndercoverTourist.com. Undercover Tourist is your secret for savings on all Disney Resorts vacations. And now, fun in the sun with Disney Cruise Lines. How about enchanting entertainment or an exclusive visit to Castaway Key? Anything's possible aboard a Disney cruise vacation. Book now with UndercoverTourist.com, an authorized seller, and get a free in-room decor package with your Disney Cruise Line booking. Plus, exclusive savings at checkout. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hi, everyone. It's Sophia, and welcome back to Work in Progress. Today, we're continuing to get to know the cast and creators of Good Sam a little better. I have met so many incredible people while working on this show, and if I could, I would introduce you to all of them. On this episode, I'm going to talk to two wonderful women. Katie Wesch is a TV and film writer. You may have seen her work without even realizing if you've watched shows like The Republic of Sarah, Rizzoli and Isles, and Jane the Virgin. She's also the creator of Good Sam and a phenomenal creative force. And Jenny Snyder-Ehrman is a writer herself, although more often credited these days as a powerhouse producer. She's produced shows like Gilmore Girls, Charmed, and 90210, won awards for the show she created and produced, Jane the Virgin, and she is also the executive producer of Good Sam. I am so looking forward to delving into their journey, their creative process, and their experience as women writing in media. Let's get to it. Hi, ladies.
Hi, Sophia.
Hello.
This is so fun, and I feel nervous.
Me too.
Okay, great. I'm suddenly like, oh, I'm gonna like interview my bosses and my friends, and what do we talk about? Oh God.
I mean, I just want to know, make sure I'm well informed enough to keep up because you know about everything.
Oh please. But this is, today's about you. It's about both of you, ladies. For our friends listening at home, I think you've all probably heard me say this many times over the last year, which really has been 2 years since we all set off on this journey together and then got postponed with the pandemic. But this working for the two of you is my favorite job that I've ever had on the spectrum of every kind of feeling and experience and an adventure and piece of dialogue and thing we're talking about. And so I think people who love shows so rarely get to really know the people who make them. And so that's all we're going to do today.
I love that.
Yeah. So, you know, it would be very easy for anybody to get on IMDb and look up either of you ladies and go, oh, okay, you know, the laundry list of the shows you've written on, worked on, the things you've created. I mean, Jane the Virgin literally changed the TV landscape, Jenny, and Katie, your experience on it. I want to dig into all of that. But I always want to know how people became the people that they are, and especially you two as the leaders that you are. You set such a high bar for excellence, but you do it with such a tenderness that everyone feels excited to show up rather than like they're in trouble every day. it's like a real masterful thing you do. And so I kind of just want to know how you both became like this, how you got to be these boss ladies with soul. And so I want to go all the way back to the beginning, you know, to know where you grew up and what your experiences were like. So who wants to go first? Tell me where you're from. Tell everyone at home where you came from.
I'm from Rye, New York, which is about 45 minutes outside of Manhattan. And that's where I'm from. And I spent my childhood just kind of trying to get closer and closer to Manhattan, I would say. It was a big part of my growing up. And I liked where I grew up, but I didn't love it. There was something about the where I grew up, I just didn't feel totally connected to everything. And I didn't really know how I fit in to my family, to my environment, to my school, everything. And so I was always like kind of looking elsewhere, but not really planning for anything. I was just kind of, I just wanted to be near the city because it felt like it had so many more possibilities than what was right around me.
Mm. So if I think about Jenny Ehrman at, you know, 10 or 12 even, what do you think you were lacking? Was it more of an ability to kind of touch the arts or creative expression, or was it a general feeling of stuckness?
It's interesting. I think, you know, I felt a little bit stuck. I describe like when I got into the sort of 14, 15 year old, I always describe myself as a bad nerd. So I would go out and get in a lot of trouble all day and do things I wasn't supposed to. And then I would come home at night and study. So I had this like rebellious side, but I was always like keeping enough in check because I knew like eventually I was going to grow out of it and I wanted to like go to college and stuff.
So you had the wherewithal to skip class, but then do your homework?
Not only skip class. I mean, I think in ninth grade, I wasn't allowed to go to classes. I was only allowed to come in for tests.
Jenny Ehrman.
I know. And so I would do that and I'd hang out and stuff and then I'd come home and I'd like memorize the glossary and stuff because I really had so many sort of conflicting parts and I couldn't quite, I wasn't like the kind of student that, I was just loud and I had a lot of ideas and I could be really disruptive and I was not good at playing by the rules back then. But I also really loved school. So, you know, in seventh and eighth grade, the reason I got into like theater and storytelling was because for eighth grade, I wasn't allowed to go to English classes or social studies classes. And instead I had to like write a play and put it on for the school. And it was about the trial of Sacco and Vanzetti, who are two Italian immigrants who were caught stealing a shoe and what it said about America. And I did not edit. Like the school came to see this, like I pretty much just put on the trial. Like I did not want to miss any turns in this saga. And then like the lead prosecutor got sick, so I had to like jump in. And after this this bizarre experience, I was just like, I love theater and I love like English and I love writing things. And then that was like the thing that I loved that always, you know, I'd always come back to even when I was like getting in other kinds of trouble. Like that was, you know, if you asked like my theater teacher, you know, she would say like, oh, Jenny's a great student. But if you asked maybe like my physics teacher, she would have a different opinion.
That is so funny. It's funny to hear you say that too, the sort of immersion that happens as a kid when you realize theater is your thing. You know, that was what changed my trajectory. It was starting to do theater that made me say, no, I'm not going to go to medical school. I thought I wanted to be a surgeon. But you mean you can bring books to life? I had this whole, you know, sort of change of heart and inspiration. And then I got to go home and tell my parents, you know, my immigrant family parents, that I wasn't going to go to medical school. I was going to go to drama school. My parents were just like, oh, fuck.
Yeah. You know? Exactly.
Not thrilled.
Yeah.
So I love that.
Yeah.
Katie, were you ever cutting class? I feel like you would not have cut class, Katie Wesch.
I know. It's so.
I didn't cut class either, except for a protest.
That feels very unfair.
Exactly.
It really tracks. Eighth grade.
I think I was a really straight stick. I really think it's very great that Jenny like planned her rebellion and like an official, like that's just good time management.
Yeah.
It's like that is really, you knew she was going to be a good showrunner. She's like, I'm just going to like really wig out for the like from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. And then I'm going to really drill down on my science project. I just think it's so perfect. But no, I didn't really have any edges around me. I just was very sort of straight and studious. And, you know, that sort of annoying kid that was always standing on the chair at lunch hour to get people to sign her petition so that, like, you know, the girls' field hockey team and lacrosse team shouldn't have to wear sheer uniforms, you guys. The football team gets new track suits every season. Mm-hmm. And everyone's just like, again with this? And, like, for
I
a
love
long
that
time,
girl.
Yes.
I have to say, like, if she walked by me now, I would be like, but like I for a long time I didn't tell anybody this because it was so embarrassing, but I had a column in the newspaper. I don't know if you know this, Jenny.
No.
And it's still mortifying, but I have to say it. It's just, God wants people to know. It was called AWARE, which stood for Are We All Really Equal?
Oh, amazing.
I
love you so much.
I don't know if amazing is the right word.
Yes.
It was like, I was just like, you guys. Yeah, I was a real freedom fighter for those lacrosse uniforms. Mm.
Mm. And where was this?
It was in Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. And I was very studious and I lived in books and my own righteousness, I suppose. And I think it just came along at some point for me, that realization of, I don't know that it was, I liked theater too, but I wasn't as, it was more about like the moment of discovering that people write the stories that I spent so much of my childhood immersed in, like that feeling of, oh, you can do that. Like you can be the one who makes the story on the TV show or whatever that is, that was kind of a light bulb moment for me and a possibility that hadn't really existed before, because you don't spend a lot of time talking about the entertainment industry if you're growing up in the Midwest, right, in the 80s. But then I started to think that might be a little bit obsessed with that idea of telling the stories started early for me.
What do you think flipped that switch?
I wish I knew like the exact show or the exact moment, but I just know that there was a before and an after of realizing that there was somebody like typing the words, that somebody was in charge of how that story happened. And I think before that, authors or writers, it didn't seem like a person to me. It didn't seem like somebody I could be. And something changed where all of a sudden it became in my mind possible to pursue that. And so then I went to college and majored in English, but I wanted to write stories that would be a thing that could get made. That was kind of as far as I could go in terms of articulating my plans. And then at some point I found out that there was like a thing called film school. And so then that seemed like a great plan for somebody like me, because I liked school. I was good at school. I understood the identity of student. And I thought if I could have all those things to support me while I went to this big city of LA, maybe I could, you know, get more info. So I applied to USC. People told me that was a hard school to get into. I figure if they let me in, it'll give me a chance. And then if they don't, I'll like do something else. So again, my planning, I don't think I was as like strategic and well organized in my planning as Jenny, but it kind of worked out. They did let me in. So then I sort of took it from there.
So you came out to go to USC, and Jenny, how did you get your shit together? You were obviously doing well academically. So when did you shift out of the 15-year-old who was like getting into trouble during the day, but acing her homework at night? What changed for you? What was the college trajectory?
So it was circuitous. So I sort of, by 16, had like sort of gone as crazy as I felt like I was going to go. Then I started to like really take my identity as a student more seriously. But I had a lot of things coming at once. Basically, I just thought like, oh, I should just apply to colleges somewhere with a good English program. I got it in my mind that my hero writer was Toni Morrison, and she taught at Princeton. So I just thought, I'm going to try to go there. So I applied there early. And then at the same time in my life, I was going through a lot of difficult stuff sort of stemming from that period, but then like kind of the fallout. So then my like senior year of college, I sort of like shrunk into this other person, and or senior year of high school, where I was anorexic and really studious and quite quiet and like retreating. And so then I went to college. I got into Princeton, was like, that's where I want to go because maybe I can take a class with Toni Morrison at some point. But I went there quite sick. So I had to like get weighed to be able to go to college, and I was a mess. And I didn't quite understand the extent of the mess until like kind of midway through that first semester. And I had like a medical crisis, and my parents like I called and they just like kind of came up and picked me up and took me home. And then I was like, oh no, I've got to get better from this in order to really spend time at Princeton. So I spent a lot of, so I spent like a semester kind of trying to get better. Finally, ultimately I did. And then I went back, and then I took another semester off because I had to even out. And then I was like working in New York, and I was, my waitressing career was like really progressing. And and I was doing like theater in New York. And so then I decided I was going to stay out for one more year because I was really like, there was something about that period of my life where I wanted to be in New York, and I really was into all the things I was doing. And I didn't want to waste sort of my education, and I didn't want to be like two places at once.
So I stayed like out. Almost like a gap year.
So I stayed out another year, so it equaled two. And then I finally went back for like the last sort of 2 years as a junior. And then I was like just like sucking in everything that college had to offer and taking as many classes as possible and just being like, you know, and a lot of people would be like, oh, you're still here. Are you a TA? Are you? Because I'd been there for a really long time. but I just sort of was on my own path. And by the time, I think when I was like, I just knew myself enough to know that if I didn't want to like waste the college experience, I wanted to like really take it in. So I did that. This is all the circuitous route, how I got to LA. So then after, I was really good friends with some of my professors in college. And one of them said to me after, like, what are you going to do? And I had like a bunch of like loose ideas. The biggest idea was that you can't be an actor. Like, you do not have thick enough skin. You're not good enough. Like, you have to find some other job. I had been in New York for 2 years. I knew that that was not a life path that was for me, because I didn't think I could handle it, honestly. And then, and I had to figure out sort of what I wanted to do. And the only other thing I loved was like writing papers. I really loved writing papers at school. And I'd always like hand them in 2 weeks early so I could get a proper good set of notes in order to like hand it back in. I mean, real nerdy. Yeah. So I was like, oh, maybe grad school. And I was thinking about that. And my professor said, I want you to meet my wife. I just feel like you will love her. And you know, I just want you to meet her. So I met her for like lunch at noon, and the lunch lasted till like 8 p.m. And I did really love her. And her name was Eleanor Bergstein, and she wrote Dirty Dancing, and was like, yes, and was like the first really just awesome radical feminist that I knew really well. And like, she had been called baby up until she was 17, like, you know, and she was just like, come work with me for this year. And she had other people working with her, and really, I was like halfway between an assistant and a friend, and like she just like, we would talk about ideas and try to like develop things together, and we would also go to lunch, and I would also pick up her dry cleaning, and it was just like this like 2 years of like while I was trying to write plays in New York, and I really loved that job. And then another friend of mine, like, had just come back from giving massages in the beach of Puerto Vallarta, and she came back and she was like, have you ever thought of writing for TV? And I was like, no, I'm here with Eleanor, and we're like mostly theater. And she was like, I would love you to write TV with me. I think you'd really be good at it. And I was like, all right, let's try that. And so she actually paid me to take a month off of work, because she had more money than I did, take a month off of work with Eleanor and write specs. I know, it was real bizarre. Write specs of different scripts that existed. So we did that for a month, and then we drove out to LA. We knew one person who read our scripts, and they were like, you know, a crazy range of scripts, because we thought like, you got to really show your range, not like look at one thing and show how you do it. So we'd do like a Law and Order and a Sex and the City and everybody, like just everything. Wow. And through that process of writing together, we liked it enough. And I liked it enough to be like, yeah, like, why not? Let's move to LA for a year. And we did. We moved to LA for a year. And I worked at Houston's and waitressed. And
I love that place.
And I was very disciplined. Like, I'd get done with work and then go back to my friend's house, and we would write for like 6 hours every night.
Jenny, yeah. I'm so struck by your self-awareness and discipline at a young age. Like, as a kid who's being, you know, what you might say, like, quote unquote, bad or naughty, who then is like, I'm going to come home and I'm going to get really good grades. And then who sort of swings so far in the other direction to prove herself that the proving becomes obsessive and then results in an eating disorder. And then you're thinking while you're working on healing from that and in treatment, you're going, you know, I'm so focused on healing and I'm in treatment and I need to kind of figure out what it is I really want to do. So I don't want to waste my opportunity at Princeton, even though I got in. So why don't I just work and get my shit together and then I'll go back to college? Like, what child thinks this way?
You know,
I want to have that kind of discipline now.
I mean, hearing it back, I feel like
wow.
You should have been my therapist for many years because you just sort of contextualized it all for me in a really
it's incredible
sort of bite-sized way in a way that I can. You know, I didn't plan anything. I just sort of I always like would have my breakdowns, with enough to like pull me back from the edges. I don't know what, but I never planned. I didn't have plans for any thing. I came to LA because like someone, you know, she's like, it would be a good idea. And I just felt like, that's great. Yeah, let's do that. And it seems so strange because now as an adult, I'm a much more like weigh the pros and cons. And I didn't have that as much as a kid, but maybe it's because I trusted that I would like know the limit and be able to like pull myself back from things if it got to be someplace past the point of no return. I'm not sure.
That's amazing. It's like, it makes me think of that thing Glennon Doyle says, where you just have to do the next right thing. But I think for me, especially when I was young, I mean, I have the tendency now, it was much worse when I was younger, of being such a people pleaser, of never wanting to be the problem. So I never wanted to be the one drawing the attention. I never wanted to get in the way. I always wanted everything to be fine. I wanted everybody to be happy. And so I don't know that I could have done that. I don't know that I would have seen it. I think about the dumb shit I did in my 20s and like I did not see it. I was so far down the road of red flags and I was like, look at this parade. It's just for me. Like, that's not what those are. You know, I didn't see it. And so it's really cool to, you know, to hear you talk about it in that way. I'm curious, did you guys get to LA kind of around the same time? Like, what year did you each move out? You moved with your friend for writing, and Katie, you moved out for college.
Yeah, I graduated from USC in, I want to say 2002?
Okay.
Yeah, so like early 2000s, I got here, and it's so funny because if you look at USC now, it's such a different place. It was like a trailer, like one trailer, and some like confused writers ambling around, and now it's this like palace, this George Lucas. People were like, George Lucas is building a thing. And it was like, because we don't have any paper in the copier. So that feels like, and now it's just a whole different place. But it was, it was a nice time to be there. I mean, the group of people that I went to school with are very inspiring. Some of them, Aaron Thomas, who runs the CBS show SWAT, is one of them. He was my, like sort of classmate. And so it was a cool time to be there at school, even though I was still trying to find my way and didn't know that I'd be in TV. Like, TV was not where I was aiming. And that time at USC, it didn't have a huge TV. It wasn't so – it's weird now to say this, but in the beginning of my career, it wasn't like you could do both TV and movies, and it was no problem. They were still very much separated. And you would go to film school because you were going to be like a movie writer. Like, the posters on the wall inside the school were not TV shows.
Right.
Right.
So I didn't really like think about that until I got toward the end of my time at school and realized that I really liked watching TV. And those were the stories that were most interesting to me, and the serialized, I think, nature of like being able to stay with a character and live with them for a long time. So that's when I started to put my attention in that direction. But it was hard. It wasn't very easy to do. I think now when you go to school there, you actually choose a track or you sort of declare which is your main interest, and then you can align yourself with professors and mentors like Jenny had that help you guide you and know what you're signing up for. Otherwise, you kind of just had to stumble through it. which is what I did.
I felt like that about my time at USC too, because I graduated high school in 2000. I would have graduated SC in 2004, but I left in 2003, right after my junior year, to go do my first job. And I felt very aimless. I was just like, I don't know what's going on here. I went for the BFA program. And then there was like this room of actors like talking about their craft. And I was like, I'm going to kill myself. I have to get out of here.
Oh, interesting.
Like, this is not for me. I really like telling stories and I like people. But this feels like something I don't know. It felt really kind of self-obsessed. So then I transferred into Annenberg. I went from the BFA theater program into Annenberg to study journalism.
Really?
And that really became my thing. And when I was in Annenberg, I started taking some classes at the film school. And then I was my sort of outside of my journalism classes, everything I packed my schedule with was political science and film. So it all makes sense now.
Totally.
But at the time, everyone was like, what are you doing?
Wow, that's really interesting. I feel like I've always said that I think journalism is a good, I think that like, at least on the writing side, a good like storytelling can be, it's sort of this it's like a reporter and a private detective. Like those skill sets are good when you go around in the world to like gather up good stuff to put in your storytelling pocket for later. If you kind of have, and you do, Sophia, I feel like that you really do absorb things, whatever you're experiencing in a moment, you do absorb them and kind of pack it away. And you have a way of integrating it and articulating it. Like even just with Jenny's story, that it is journalistic in nature. I just think you have that instinct naturally.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's enviable. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's very kind coming from two of my favorite writers. It's probably because as a kid, I was so obsessed with Oprah. Like, you guys, I was in elementary school and I would say to my mom, if I get straight A's, will you take me out of class 12 minutes early every day so we can get home by 3 o'clock instead of getting home at 3:12 because I missed the first 12 minutes of Oprah? And my mom was like, be quiet, 7-year-old. Like, what are you talking about? But that's all I wanted. I was like, I just want to sit down and I want to watch this woman interview people. Mm. I want to watch her help people tell their stories. It was my favorite thing to do. So I think it's why the theater energy, I was like, no, I like theater. I like plays. I like doing that stuff. I went all through high school doing it. But the sort of like, you know, gravity of a theater education, I was like, this is creeping me out. It feels too weird. I'm just going to go tell people's stories over there instead.
Yeah, that makes sense. I get
so much sense. Totally. Mm.
So I know you said that, you know, you were referencing Jenny's mentors, you know, working for the writer in New York and then partnering up with your friend to come out and write in LA. Did you feel, Katie, like you had mentors in school at all? Or because the department was still a little unformed at the time, do you feel like you had to find a mentor once you graduated?
Well, I think I had teachers all along the way who, when I look now at the continuum, I see were pushing me in the direction of being a writer. You know, it's so powerful that one teacher that just looks at you and says, like, you should keep doing this. You know, it's amazing how things become possible when you realize that people see you a certain way. And so that was true for me even from high school. And I had a teacher who wrote a book, and that was like one of those things where you're like, huh, you just went ahead and wrote it then. You just, you know. And then I think I also had that. I did have help in film school. I had support and people who guided me. And I've been really lucky in my career that I've always had awesome women around me, even when I was just starting out as a lowly assistant bringing people coffee. And, you know, I've had always somebody to kind of focus my sights on and help me as a guiding light to imagine how I would want my path to go and kind of how I would want to be while I was on that path. I just was really lucky in that way, you know, that I think sometimes you have to build a career around what not to do, what you've experienced that you don't want to repeat. But I'm happy to say I also had positive influences that I just could like take those experiences and pack them up so that I could draw from that as well. Like, that person's really decent and kind and patient. And that person has an incredible tolerance for other people's stories and nonsense that don't pertain to this moment in time, but they have a kindness and an interest in them as a human being that helps morale, or just whatever it would be that somehow would give you a nice little lesson to take with you. So I had that kind of all throughout Lucky Me. And I know probably, I mean, maybe that's not a common story to say, so it's good to say that it is true that sometimes it's not always like, it was hell getting here. You know what I mean? Like, obviously it's not an easy business and I had my troubles and challenges like everybody, but I also had a lot of good influences.
It's also really a testament to your constant presence as an observer. It's really interesting to me to watch you in a room because you're the creator. I mean, you created this show and this whole world and you're managing storyboards. And I mean, my God, your office is like a very well-organized version of A Beautiful Mind. Like coming in the writer's room and seeing all the boards and the post-its and the stickies and the things and the under every single episode number. And you're just like, how do these people do this? But yet you have so much that you have to manage. But when you come in a room, you're paying attention to everyone else and you see how people behave, you see what their skills are. Even when we talk about people on our crew, the reasons you hire people, the things that you request of department heads, the way you allow people to really like show off in their skill sets is all because you observe what their strengths are. And I'm fascinated by the amount of information you are able to not only take in, but identify and then hand back to people as like trophies. Oh, you will say to anyone who you are around, well, this is a thing you're really incredible at. I want you to do more of it. And I watch people light up and I'm like, you're managing like 19 scripts right now. How did you even, you're on your phone sending notes to the studio, but you noticed the thing the guy was doing in the corner? Like, and maybe that comes with being a mom, like you have eyes in the back of your head. I have no idea, but I'm endlessly impressed by that. So I'm not surprised when you talk about the things you were observing in your early writing career. It's like, well, of course you noticed that.
Oh, man, thanks. I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I think it probably is. I think being a parent does help you be a better producer. For me, anyway, it's true that you have to really be good at divided focus, like tasks that require divided focus and prioritizing like urgency and level of need with regard to your attention. And also, I think as a parent, I mean, I don't know, I can only speak for my kids, but they don't, like, I don't get great results out of them when I'm like a real hard ass or something. You know what I mean? Maybe if I had like a really great experience, then that would be more of my management style. But I find with these humans that I'm, you know, doing my best with, my husband Gabe, to raise, that a sort of loving and compassionate approach is more productive and feels better for everybody. So maybe that is part of, just kind of flows into everything.
Well, it feels better, I think, in general. It was so sweet. You know, we just did the hospital room scenes for episode 107 in the timeline for everyone at home of when we're doing this recording. And we have these two lovely women guest starring in the episode. And they talked about how it's the nicest set they've ever worked on. And sweet darling Jordan from props said, oh, hands down. And he just jumped right in and he said, hands down, it's the best set. And you know why? Because there's a group of incredible women who run it. So it's better for all of you. But just so you know, it's better for us guys, too.
I was so like, glad Jordan, to hear that. Yes, thank you.
He's so lovely.
He is such a sweetheart and what a hard worker.
He's an angel.
God, really appreciate that. So I'm really glad you told us that, Sophia, because I've always said, you know, you've heard me say that I have two goals. They are to create a hit show on television and to make an environment where people say, what a great place to come to work every day. And both of those things are equally important to me. One is not a success without the other. So I really feel like, to me, that's the measure, you know, of how we're doing. And so it means so much to me, as much as somebody saying that they love to watch the show is that they love to work on our show. But also they've got a leading lady who knocks your socks off and sets that tone every day. We're only there on set for such a blink of an eye compared to those long hours and the time that you guys spend together in that trench. I mean, I just don't think anybody understands how long the hours are that you work and what, talk about focus. And you have to be on camera for all of it. So to be able to do that with grace and generosity. That mood completely flows through everything. I feel like you need to know that in my mind, and I know in Jenny's mind, you're part of that equation. Mm. When they say there's a group of great women at the top setting the tone, that's all of us together doing that. I don't think we could do it otherwise the same way. You know what I mean?
Thanks, pals. Yeah. See, everyone, I bet everybody at home's going, aw, and that's it. Like, you can see why we love what we do so much. So to get to our wonderful show that we love to make, from the point where, Jenny, you've been in LA and you're committed to being there with your best friend and writing spec scripts for a year, and Katie, you've graduated from USC and gleaned your lessons along the way, what happens next? Like, you know, Jenny, you wind up being named one of the 10 writers to watch by Variety. That's a really big deal. Katie, you're out like getting movies made. What happens? How does it begin? Because I know there are people who love our industry who listen to this podcast and go, I just have no idea where I would even start.
Yeah, you know, when I try to give people advice, I feel like there is a path that is, you know, get around writers' rooms. So, you know, work as a PA, try to get to be a writer's assistant. Doesn't matter, a PA, no matter where you are, because you're going to get around people and you're going to create a community of younger people who all want the same thing. And if you can do that, that's great. I don't know what it was about this moment in my life or a few moments, but I had no plan and I had no, I didn't really question it other than like, oh, I just got to write and make your scripts really good, which is not like me. I didn't say to myself, oh, I'll give yourself 2 years. Or my friend and I never talked about that. We just sort of moved to LA and we moved here. It was really traumatic. We got here September 10th. I think I've spoken to you about that.
Oh, yeah.
Of 2001. It was a really traumatic entry here. And it took like, 4 months before we really, I think, left the house. And we're like, oh, okay, we're here permanently. Like, we gotta start to move and like try to write and, you know, emotionally heal through writing also, which is why it's such a great job, because you can also tend to your soul. But I really just waitressed and wrote scripts like every single day and was really, really disciplined about it. And then I would go to all these meetings. I remember like I would just, you know, especially if they were at Fox, because it was right by Houston's where I worked. And I'd be like, oh, Arnold Palmer, Ice-T. I just recognized everyone. I knew all their orders. I was like, I recognize these people from my day job. Oh, my God, could they really help me? And we just kept writing. We just kept writing scripts. And we got to a meeting on our first show. And it was the writer who also became a big mentor of mine. And it was her first show. So she also didn't have this sort of preconceived notion of all the steps you had to do in order to get there. Mm-hmm. We just had a really fun meeting and she was like, I want to hire those two girls. Like, they seem interesting and funny and different. So she did. And it was 15 years ago. So it was in that sort of time where you were like, oh, do you have your girl on the comedy staff? Oh, you have your girl. Mm-hmm. You don't need another one. She didn't have that. She was a woman. This was her first job. And she was like, so we had like a really beautiful room. I felt really taken care of by her. And she was always actively looking to mentor me. And so we ended up moving back to New York for our first job. So we were here for like 18 months, I would say, and then got relocated back to New York. And I remember when I got the call from our agent that we got a job on this sitcom that was shooting in New York, I was like, okay, hold up. I just have to call Houston's, make sure I can transfer because I don't want to lose my health insurance. And he was like, you're going to have to leave the restaurant. And I was like, I'm not going to be leaving the restaurant. Like,
no.
I have a really good position. And I'm on the rail, which means that like people are coming in and out and I'm making a lot of money at lunch. And you know, I have health insurance. I really don't want to leave it. And he's like, you have to leave it. And we had like sort of some words about it. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to leave the restaurant, like, even though I wasn't sure it was going to work out and I felt that I was going to regret it. And also Houston's had a lot of New York branches, so I really thought it could all work out. But then once I got in a writer's room, I quickly realized like, I wasn't going to be making waitressing shifts. It's a really like long hour. The hours are really long and like all your energy is used. But I was like clearing everyone's dishes in the writer's room for a really long time because I was also like, oh, my God, they get us lunch too. This is crazy. They'd be like, oh, you have to stay for dinner tonight. And I'd be like, too bad. But in my heart, I was like,
darn,
amazing. We get dinner. We get to sit around with these fun people. I have very little going on outside of this. This is great. But, you know, I tried to act like duly disappointed at the late hours.
That is incredible. You just reminded me, I haven't thought about this in years. When I first booked One Tree Hill and I had to go to North Carolina, I was like, but it's my senior year in college. Like, I can't, I can't miss my senior year in college. And then I genuinely asked. I looked my showrunner and you know, producing team dead in the face and said, well, do you think it might be possible for me to, like, I mean, I'll do the flying, but do you think I might be able to just go home like 2 days a week so I can stay in class? And they looked at me. They were like, what? No, no.
You're the only one who asked that. That's...
Yeah. They were like, you're going to be working like 100 hours a week. And I was like, what? What do you mean? Like, I just didn't know because I'd never worked on a show like
totally.
That. I love it. Oh, the innocence of like, well, I'll keep my waitressing job, right? Like, yeah. Oh, it's perfect. I also really want to know when you're like talking about who ordered an Arnold Palmer. I'm like, who works at Fox also likes the spinach artichoke dip from Houston's because it's all I can think about. And I want to know who I can share a snack with. Next time we all have a meeting.
Everyone loved the spinach artichoke dip.
Okay, great. Okay,
yeah, a big, big, big seller.
Wow. So first job takes you back to New York. And then Katie, what becomes the first moment for you?
I graduated from film school and then I had a sort of a period of time where I had a bunch of jobs that weren't in the entertainment business. I had a little trouble with my sort of first step on the ladder. And it was a rocky time for me because that my dad died and I was just like in my early 20s and broke. And my mom was sort of like at a point of her life where she now had to completely like recalibrate, you know, she's only in her 50s or whatever. And now she didn't have my dad. So it was hard. I wasn't sure, should I go home and help her back to Michigan or stay this very uncertain course, you know, it was so my writing was not the most, I wasn't the most productive I'd ever been at the very start. And I was grateful finally to land a job as a writer's PA because it gave me structure and it made sense to me in a way that the movie business continues to not make sense. In other words, I wrote a Disney movie that got made. I don't think that was the one that got made that day. There is really no merit or logic around why some movies go forward and some don't. And it's very stressful and weird as a result, or at least it was for me, compared to TV, where it's like, all right, if I bring these people their coffee and I like really nail it and I learn as much as I can while I'm doing it, then the next time around, I'll get to be like one step higher on the chain, right. And eventually I'll get to sit in the seat at the table with the writers and write the scripts. Like, there was a trajectory that made sense to me in a way that I couldn't make sense of movies. And so I was excited about that and threw myself into it. And then TV really became my main interest. And then that's how it went along for me. And I climbed my way up the ranks from the coffee bringer to staff writer and onward from there until I, you know, was a co-EP on enough shows and started to think about maybe I could have developed my own show and run it, you know, which just takes time, or at least it did for me.
Yeah. Will you give the folks at home kind of like a little, I hate to make people do it, but a little like resume laundry list of the latter, because some people will have actually gone on your IMDBs and some will not have. And I want them to know what we're talking about.
I know. I wonder what mine even said. My first, job was
Before I move on, fun fact, your Disney movie Prom.
Yeah.
Nicholas Braun was in.
Yes, he was.
And in 2011, it might have even been 2010, he played my little brother in a film.
Is that right?
And obviously now everyone loves him as Cousin Greg on Succession, but he's just one of my favorite people.
He's so good.
So when I realized you guys had worked together and also... You know why it's hilarious to think of him as my little brother, since he's literally twice as tall.
Yeah,
he's the tallest person I know. But that was a fun little thing.
Oh, he's okay, so
back
great.
Back to trajectory.
I started on a show, a Fox show that was like shot in Hawaii. It was called North Shore. It was supposed to be a companion piece to a show called The OC from 500 years ago, and it was okay. It only went for a season, but the lucky thing about being the assistant. Writers PA on that show is that staff of writers happened to be like the future showrunners of any show you've ever seen in the subsequent.
Wow.
Like, so I just really did a good job bringing them their lunches and making them like me. And then they kept hiring me on other shows. And that's how I ended up on Prison Break and, you know, a bunch of other shows. They just kept being people who I had met when I was an assistant and then just applied myself to making them, to charming them into continuing to let me be around. And that's even how my first staff writer job came my way. So I did a couple of, you know, I just kind of kept going along on that ladder. But a lot of the shows mm-hmm. that I worked on in the beginning of my career only lasted one season. So right. I have a lot of experience with shows that, that's why I have a lot of shows on my resume, because it would be like, okay, that one's not going forward. You hop onto another one. And mm-hmm. it, the good thing about something like that is you get to meet a lot of people and see a lot of different styles of running yeah. a room and breaking story and just the dynamics of people in a rooms, what succeeds and what doesn't and what, you know, makes everybody happiest or least happy. So that was sort of most of my career was characterized by those sort of shorter stints until I later on landed on shows like Brazilian Isles and Jane the Virgin that went for long numbers of seasons. And I was able to kind of settle into a place and a show for a length of time, which was a delight.
I love that. And then when you talk about becoming a co-EP, can you tell people what that means?
Yeah, it's like there's this whole funny rank system, like the way the Army has or something, that's just sort of reflective of the amount of time, I guess, that you've been a writer and how much time you've spent in the room and on set and what your kind of skill set is. And it grows every year that you're working. And therefore, you go from like staff writer to, I think, something called story editor and executive story editor and then co-producer. It mounts. You'll see those names on the screen, right? Supervising producer, co-executive producer. They just yeah. indicate sort of the length of kind of seniority, I guess, more than anything else.
Cool.
And so when you're like at a co-EP level, that probably means you're one of the people in that writer's room who's been doing it the longest. That's one of the things it can mean. There's other ways that you can end up with a title like that, but that for me is what it meant.
Yeah. And then, you know, it also signifies you hear this thing of like who you want to get, like who's a value add to a show. So the writers that are at the co-EP level, the studio gets excited about being able to get a writer like that on a show, just like they get excited about getting an actor with a you know, a real resume and a fan base in a character role. It's all just, yeah, how long you've kind of been putting in the shoe leather.
Yeah.
And then Jenny, for you, you go to do the sitcom in New York, and then what does your trajectory look like?
You know, I stayed in the sitcom for 3 years, which was really awesome and a real gift because I was able to like continue in that. I had a writing partner my first year, my same one of my college best friends. And then she decided that it wasn't quite for her, and I decided it was exactly for me. So I was able to, so when she left, I stayed on and I just made sure that I had to, I just rewrote all my samples because I had to come out of this job with a resume that was only things that I had written as opposed mm-hmm. to a shared credit. So I stayed there. I was there for the whole run, 3 years. And during that time, it was kind of like the beginning of dramedies, I would say, really, mm-hmm. when suddenly, I think my last year or the second to last year of Hope and Faith, there was suddenly Desperate Housewives mm-hmm. and Grey's Anatomy and like, and then The Office, like, you know, it I was just like, oh, I don't want to stay in sitcoms. I really wanted mm-hmm. to move. So I made sure that I wrote a lot of specs that last year so that for any job that became available, I would have the right sample. So I wrote like, you know, a Desperate Housewives. I wrote an Office. Then I wrote a single camera comedy. Then I wrote an hour long dramedy. Then I wrote a procedural. I just wrote all that while having this job just so that I could have choices when I transitioned. Because I knew I wanted to not only be in sitcoms. And it was at the moment also there weren't that many jobs in sitcoms because they weren't as popular suddenly. So I just had to be prepared. And then a writer who had left the year before, Hope and Faith, had gone on to Gilmore Girls, and then he was going to run it that last year. And he said, I wanted to bring you on. Do you have any samples that we can show the studio of a 1 hour? I was like, do I ever? You know, I'd written all these. And so then I went on to that show, and I loved it. I just really, like, loved that style of writing. And I didn't get to work with Amy Sherman-Palladino, but just her voice was so inspiring to me. I really, I
and
watched.
The pace.
And the scripts were 77 pages, and a normal hour long show, you're looking at like 55. So they were 22 pages longer than an average script, and we didn't cut anything because all the characters talked that fast. And so I listened to six seasons of Gilmore Girls just with my eyes closed to get the rhythms of the characters and to really understand the way, oh, they're starting a scene on this thing and you're going to then go through and then you're going to hit the plot over here and then you're going to bring up that thing you thought was a non sequitur here and then you're going to close it off with the joke that you set up three lines down. I mean, I like studied it like math so that I could go in and really get that voice because I felt like it was so challenging but also so delightful if you can get into that sweet spot. And that was a really like exciting creative time for me. And then after that, I went through a few jobs that didn't, you know, like 1 year, 2 year, 3 year. I did Men in Trees. I did Lipstick Jungle. I did 90210. And then the studio had asked me to write a pilot. So I wrote a pilot that they shot and didn't go. But I was like, oh, this is fun. And then I was like, I really want to get a show on the air. So I set out to do that. And I wrote a medical procedural. It was the first thing I wrote. And it was a really like lovely experience, but also didn't get picked up and was also, you know, it went for 13 and then it was so exhausting. And it was my first sort of understanding of like, oh my God, show running is a very different job than being someone else's number two. And it was a real like, holy shit moment for me. And then after that show got canceled, I just had to really think about what I wanted to do next. And Jane the Virgin came out of that at just this totally opposite direction. I wanted to write something totally different. And then from there, I've gotten to, you know, lucky enough to have that show and then get to develop and help other people sort of get their shows on, which is like a great part of the job that I didn't anticipate doing, but I could not love more. So
that's so cool. And then you guys, that's where this brilliant merger that's made my life so happy happened. So how did that, what pixie dust got sprinkled around to put the two of you together?
It's totally pixie dust.
And his name, the pixie's name.
And his name is Micah Schrepp. Yeah, so I had worked on, this is one of those things, you know, where the longer you do it and the more people you know, because for me, I had worked on a CW show that didn't last long, but I worked with someone who I loved in that writer's room named Micah Schrepp, and he then found it, I think subsequent to that, he and Jenny started doing Jane together. Yeah. And it so happened that in the fourth season of Jane, they were looking for somebody and Micah called me up and said, is there any chance you'd be available? I think he said, I have a money-making scheme for you, which is very on brand for him. How would you like to meet with Jenny for Jane? And it was so great because I'd worked for so long on shows that were in their first season. It was not a lot. I didn't have the experience so much of coming to work for a show that I was already a fan of. So I brought all that same enthusiasm that Jenny is talking about that she felt joining Gilmore Girls. That's how I felt coming in to Jane and just to really, again, be like, people, there's somebody that makes this like awesome, wacky, wonderful thing. There's like, these are the people who make it. This is the woman that like, it springs from her head, like out of Zeus's head, five seasons of this show, I think she just, here she, and it's all our jobs to sort of stand there and try to midwife it as best we can. And I was so happy to get to do that. We had such fun together. So that was the beginning for me that I was just like, hot damn, this is going to be good.
Yeah, and Micah's just, he's just one of these magical people and really magical writers. So he just said, I got the writer for you. This is her. And, you know, when you trust somebody and they know both how you work, what the room is, what the room needs, right? So like Micah saying, oh, we've got the perfect writer. I know he's not just telling me his friend, although they were friends. I knew he needs an excellent writer in this room too, because it makes everyone's life easier. So just like that trust. And that's why I think that what Katie said is so true about that like ladder of like going from show to show, there's so much benefit to it because you learn what to do, you learn what not to do. And you also just meet people who are going to be useful at different moments of your career. Mm. I feel like for that, Micah saying Katie's the perfect writer was like, she's clearly the perfect writer. And then I was like, oh my God, she's better than, and he's like, I told you. It was just like beautiful. And I remember writers being like, whoa, she's come in and gotten it so quickly. Whoa. Like that, there was definitely that sense from Katie right away. And the joy that she brings to the room and like, the seriousness she takes the job, but also the humor with which she does the job was all like sort of perfect for what we were lucky enough to have in Jane.
Aww. I love that. That tracks so much. It makes me think about going into our writer's room before we came up here to start the first season to hear you pitch it. And I was like, all my expectations blown out of the water, all my hopes laughable now. Like what came out of your mouth for an hour, I was just like, what's happening? We get to do this? Like, this is what our show is going to be? And it's so cool to think about you guys kind of, you guys merging and making something. Like, it feels like the beginning of the Captain Planet energy that I always talk about on the set. I'm like, something's going on and all the rings are coming together and magic is happening.
Yeah.
And it's good for the planet.
It is magic. I feel
it's
like that
magic.
Too. And I feel that way about our writer's room. I definitely feel like there are days when I'm so in awe of what this aggregate of people are able to put to make, you know, yeah. And they're like the ideas and everybody just bringing the best of themselves and their experience and building this together. It is magic. I think that's the right word for it. It's incredible that any one show gets made and does this with success. And then you just think it's like happening all over town. And we have like, just look at how much there is to watch. It's a dazzling, weird alchemy that I love.
Totally.
It's so cool. So when I think about some of the, you know, the stories that you guys have told, especially as you were climbing that ladder, you've worked on shows that, you know, they center on women protagonists. They focus on female experiences. And just like we were referencing with Jordan and Props, they make everybody happy. I think sometimes when you tell a story, people go, oh, it's like you got to hit me with an issue. You guys have managed to sort of move the spotlight to let people shine, but everybody has a good time watching these shows. What draws you to centering your female characters, but how do you also create these rich lives for all your characters, do you think?
How do we do that, Jenny?
You know, for me, the thing that unlocked writing for me, like in my own experiences, is writing the story and then really taking a pass of the script from everyone's point of view. And like, it's like a step that I, you know, I'll be tired and I'm like, get it out. But then I'm like, wait, I haven't read it through from this character that you think is a side character. I just want to read it through as though I'm that person, right? And like, just to make sure that everyone is not turning other people's plots arbitrarily because you need their plot to turn, but that they're coming in with their own agenda and their own like big life. And that's like a step that once I recognize that, I feel like it made my writing much better because, you know, we know everyone is the star of their own show. We know that like everyone is the, you know, they're the hero, and just really being honest about every character, like what they want, what they need, and why they would be doing this, not just to service the one, I think has made the fabric richer. And then I also give myself a rule that like, no matter how much I love a line or a joke makes me laugh, I will always take it out if I feel like it's selling out the character in some way. Like if I feel like it's not honest to what they would do, or if I have to do too many mental gymnastics to rationalize something, I just take it out. And it's like, sometimes it's painful because you're like, ah, oh, that's going to be funny no matter what. But if it's not going to be something that the character would say, I got to lose it. And so I just really hold myself to do those two things. And, you know, sometimes you're more successful than other times. But if I do those, then for me, the script is as strong as I can make it at that moment.
That's awesome.
Very cool. And what do you think, Katie? What is it for you?
I really agree with what Jenny's saying. And I think on our show in particular, what I know has helped me and our writers a lot is just that we happen to have such an incredibly strong group of people in our cast. So all of you have helped build who these characters have become in such a genuine way. And because I've been able to be a part, like we are so connected in this process of making it from the page to the screen, that I feel that I also know when things are hard for you guys to make true, right? Mm-hmm. So if anything feels like Jenny's saying that it's just a little bit, it's just not as good as it could otherwise be. And I can see the struggle that's happening on your end because it's just not gelling. It's just not up to the measure of what we've established for this character and the work that we've been doing. It falls short. That's like a really good way that's like a great standard that we've set for everybody. So if you just imagine, how would I feel if I were Sophia getting this scene? Like, how would I feel if I'm Omar? Like, I don't know how to play this because it feels like it's wacky. Then it really just does inform what's what we can do to make it better. So for me, I think thinking about you guys and the process and just remembering that, like, you, that humanity and realness is why it's so good and genuine, the work that you're doing. You're not, nobody can just like puppet this stuff. You've got to really feel it, and it has to be true. So finding that truth for each character, yeah, that's the key. That's really, I like the way Jenny put that.
Well, we're talking about our show, but why don't we really, really talk about our show? You know, we're on this adventure that, like I said earlier, we've been on for 2 years together, which also I think is such a testament to what Good Sam is, to what you guys have made. What was your, two questions, what was your inspiration for writing the show, and how did the two of you decide to partner up to do it? How does that happen?
That's lucky for me because it was Jenny's idea. You tell him, Jenny.
I just really wanted to work on a pilot with Katie. Like, you know, you just, she's just such a singular voice. She's such an excellent collaborator. She's so original, surprising. So, you know, when you get your own shows, you then start to go into this other realm where you can start to, like, you know, use the fact that there's trust in you at a studio or a network to, like, throw it behind other people and help them get their voice out there. And Katie was somebody, her pilots were beautiful. She had written one the year before that got made. She'd been such a spectacular writer in the Jane Room. I was just like, I gotta get my hands on her. Like, I want a Katie Wetch original. I want to work with her. So I just asked her out to dinner and, like, threw some just general ideas at her to see if anything sparked, because, you know, ideas, like, they're nothing if somebody doesn't attach and build and world. So, you know, I just threw out a couple things, just wondering what she would connect to. And the father-daughter dynamic in a hospital is one that Katie sparked to. And then from that, like, she said, let me think about it. And then, like, cut to Katie telling us about this show. And me and Joanna Klein, my partner, just sitting there going, like, yeah, oh, what? Oh my gosh, no. Like, just twisting and turning, and, like, she had it all worked out, and she had all the characters and all the reasons and all the, it was beautiful. So it was like one of those collaborations you just, like, hope that you'll be lucky enough to get to participate in. And then, like, so many people are great writers, but, you know, show running is its own special skill. And Joanna and I have just said, like, a million times over the course of this year, like, how lucky we are just to be such a wonderful writer and showrunner. And the fact that Katie is so extraordinary at both of those is not lost on anyone. So it's inspiring. Mm-hmm. It's inspiring for me to get to be around and to watch her do it in such a excellent, excellent way.
Thanks, Jenny. Well, I had a good model. A good model. It is two totally different skills, I would say, and often, like, contradictory skills, because to write, you're sort of turned inward, right? Like, you're listening to the voices in your head and having a whole elaborate conversation, in fact, if you're me. And then somehow as a showrunner, you need to turn outward and plug into other people and their experiences and be sort of a manager of this larger operation. And so, like, that is a weird combination of skills, and it's not like, you don't go to business school usually to get into that spot, so you kind of, like, figure out whether you are up for it in, like, the highest possible stakes, most fast-paced time when everyone's, like, staring at you. And so it's like, oh, okay, well, we'll see how this goes. So I also, in that way, I do think that, again, parenthood has helped me, because there's just a lot of that, right, where you're just like, you don't know what going to come at you, but whoever stays the calmest wins, I always say, is my rule of parenting. And so that has been a helpful tool, as you just figure it out as you kind of go and count on the people you know you can count on, the way I count on Jenny, and go together, you know, down the road, like we all are. And so that I feel like there is this trust thing all around in that regard. Like, we don't know what this is going to be. I hope it's good. Like, I hope we do a good job. And
it's kind of like going off a roller coaster together. You're like, oh God, what's going to happen? It's fun. I'm scared.
Yeah. And there's so 100%. Much you can't control. All you can really do is be like, sure that, no, you know, you're the hardest working person that you know, that you're mm-hmm. setting an example and creating an environment that you would want to be in, and then just do the work, you know? Mm-hmm. In the end, I think that's like all of us. That's just kind of where what it comes down to, right? The rest you have to jettison in order to really be focused on that in a singular way.
Yeah. How do you guys then, and because you said it, it's a crazy job. The hours are insane. It's like a runaway train, and it is evolving as we go. We have episodes on the air. We have episodes in the can. We have episodes you're still writing to shoot as we're airing. How does your understanding, both, you know, for you as a showrunner, for you as a producer, how does the understanding of the show evolve in real time?
Yeah, it does evolve in real time. I think that there's like this balance between knowing what you want the show to be, what you think the show is and isn't, right? What well enough that you can help steer and direct people as you start to build it. And then also having the flexibility to be able to understand where we succeed most, what sorts of stories and ideas maybe aren't as strong in this particular iteration for us, you know, like the balance of things that we can manage and do well on this show is a question everybody has to ask themselves and answer on a show by show basis. Mm-hmm. So we do have, you have to be able to be flexible. I say to the writers, like that's part of the reason why we move as fast as we move, so that we have time to double back if there is something we need to adjust or try to shore up in the name of what we discover along the way, like you're saying. Mm-hmm. So you just do the best you can. Sometimes it is like a little bit of you're sort of running to catch the train, but hopefully you can stay out enough ahead to be able to do the best job you can at that. I think that I describe it as like holding a braid. You know, you've got all these pieces and they need to keep, you really can't drop one or you're going to see it. And like, you might end up with a pretty good braid, but there's still going to be that like little bit of a loopy part, you know, so you just kind of get better and better at holding all of those pieces together. And then it sort of falls in, you know?
Oh, I love that. And something that I'm curious about as well. One of the things I love so much about you both is the way that you talk about your careers, that you truly are both these powerhouses who do all of it. And I don't mean like the tacky, like she does it all, you know, my least favorite headline, you know, she may be 50, but she's just getting started. I'm like, she's not just getting started. She has a 40-year career. Like, come on. I want to know what the phase is, but let's not be like patronizing. So I know how irritating it can be when people say, and they say it to women, like, well, what about your work-life balance? And I'm like, you never ask the men who run the shows. You know, people will say to me, because I'm getting married, they're like, well, how does your soon-to-be husband feel about the hours you work? And I'm like, have you ever asked a guy who leads a show this question about his wife? Like, come on. But I am genuinely curious because I look up to the way that you both do it. How you do, as you mentioned, Katie, that sort of divide and conquer attention between running production companies and having studio deals and running TV shows and having your romance and your children. Like, how do you think you've gotten so good at doing it?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, like on any given day, I'd be like, you might want to ask the other members of my family how well they think. Like, I don't know. I don't know the answer because I really do think it's like, we just do this one day at a time. Mm-hmm. And some days I don't feel at all that I am succeeding at that balance. And I sort of live in the anxiety of like somebody I'm, you know, letting down or some way that I can't be as much as I want to be in some particular area. And so it's probably like just more the way that I'm wired, that it's like, the challenge of sort of getting, not letting that, eclipse all the things that are going well and to just kind of mm-hmm. keep doing the best you can on a one day at a time. But I wouldn't say that like I have a secret magic recipe for that balance. I used to say to people, you know, cause I feel like I've been pregnant a lot while I've been on staff and on set and just like breastfeeding and trying to figure out like how do you do that while you're like in a writer's room for 10 hours or whatever. I have said like, I think that you can have it all that you want, mm-hmm. but you might not be able to have it all at the same time. Right. Like, yeah, there might just be a way that you have to sort of start to understand what's possible in terms of timing and just resource allocation.
Yeah.
So I think that it makes sense for me now, with my kids being a little bit older and all in school, to be a person who has her own show. When I had little babies, I would not have been able to be the showrunner that I am right now, because I just would not have, I just wouldn't be that person. So for me, that timing works in my favor, and I have an understanding of that now with the advantage of that perspective. So I might have been eager to have this, all this back then, but I don't think now that that would have been right, if that's any use to anyone. Yeah.
That is, that's actually really reassuring and inspiring to hear, because it reminds you that, you know, just in the same way that the planet has tides, that you have tidal moments in your life. And it's like, this is a high tide moment where I have very little sand for other things. This is a low tide moment. Look how big my beach is. I can go do all this stuff. Like, things do have to shift in the sort of amount they take up, because all you have is 100%.
Yeah.
But if you're willing to take different percentages through the stages of your life, you can experience all the things that you want to experience. I like that.
I
see Jenny nodding. You're just like, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I like that a lot. I like that a lot. I mean, for me, it's just having a husband that was willing to take time off of work and his career and stay home with kids. Like that, it was as sort of that is the only way that I was able to do the job. It's so exhausting. It's really like so many full-time jobs at once. Like, right, you know, running the writer's room is its own, and then managing production and then editing is like three full-time jobs at once. And my kids were young during Jane. Poppy was 2 and Theo was probably 4.
Wow.
And it really took having, you know, making accommodations. Number one, putting my office right by my house. So it was a block away, you know, so I could be there in the morning. I could go home at night, put people to bed, and then work again. And it was really having my husband willing to take off and do that. And then to me, then everything becomes essential. So for me, work and family were essential. I really love all of my friends, and they're going to be my friends for life, but I knew I wasn't going to see them that much over 5 years. And I didn't, like, but like, I'm just as close now, but I just, you know, I didn't have time to go out to dinner or to like do things like that, because that would be time away then from the kids, who needed time in general. Or I would let them sleep with me at night because I could feel that they were needing more, you know, like you're more flexible in those areas. And then I just really tried to take the positive. I mean, it's hard. You feel guilt all the time. You feel pulls and pushes. But I would try to balance the complaining about like, I'm tired, I have so much work to do, with also letting them know that, but God, I'm so lucky I get to do this work, because it's a job in the arts and I've been working towards this my whole life. And I really hope that when you're older, you find something that you're this passionate about too.
Yeah.
So that was an important thing to thread into the family life, that they knew it wasn't like I had to work, but that it was also, because it is my meditation, like writing when I'm by myself is my like self-care, you know, that's how I self-soothe. That's how I do, you know, so really just understanding there's hard moments, and that there are moments where you're like, oh, nothing can exist today but my kids, because they need that right now. And if I have to stay up all night when they go to bed and deal with the show stuff, I will. And then also being like, okay, you know, I am so lucky that my husband drives them to school and picks them up. Like, wow, what a privilege, you know, that is. You know, I have a really hard job and I'm not a single parent. That's really so lucky. And, you know, I don't have a traditional household dynamic where I'm also expected to do this giant job and cook at the end of the day, because I can't cook, you know, so he does. So that is the only thing that's made it possible for me.
That's so cool. Well, it's like, Katie, it's like what you said. You can have it all, just not all at the same time. And I do think in so many modern relationships, it creates a whole new sort of division of labor and expectations. And I've actually loved finding that, you know, in my life, in my modern love.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you have to talk realistically about what is going on. What are our goals here? What are we willing to sacrifice in the name of those goals? Will like, if this show, like, is our thing that we're doing right now, are we mutually invested in its mm-hmm. thriving and the, what the compromises are going to equal, right? Like, those are conversations that you want to have as early on as possible so that you're not, like, in the middle of the storm and then, you know, your partner that you're so reliant on for that balance is, like, feeling super that the balance is uneven or that they're not, you know, participating in that dynamic in a fair way. So that's like just about communication, right? Like so much stuff just comes down to being honest about that and what are mm-hmm. our limitations and expectations of each other. And
yeah,
like that's just the kind of talk about a work in progress. I mean, I think that's true in probably any marriage really, but I think when you're in some kind of like really demanding circumstances that are really unusual or unprecedented for that marriage, it's important to talk a little bit about it. It's
yeah, like, for sure.
How are we going to do this?
It's a family affair, show running. It really is.
Yeah. Like,
everyone's affected.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel show acting.
Yes,
for sure. I can't even imagine what you know, when you, the way that you guys have to do all this. And then it makes me think about, you know, the larger scope of both of your careers. You know, Jenny, you've got a big studio deal. You're like, you're producing so many things. Katie, likewise, you are creating so many shows. You've written so many scripts. How do you guys think about, as we talk about, you know, spinning all these plates, balancing on one foot, how do you think about what's next or what else you feel that artistic craving to do while we're doing this? How does that part work?
Oh my gosh. I mean, yeah, for me right now, it's like episode by episode inside of this one show and this mm-hmm. world and in my life, more than other times when I've felt like I'm looking for the next thing, you know, mm-hmm. I think that, and I think it has to do both with like an idea when it's those times that you're looking for the next thing or what else you're developing. It's the idea itself. And for me, also the mm-hmm. people that you're working with, to go back to where we started, you know, that more and more, I realize that I can do my best work with the best people that I know. And so how can those things all happen together so that it can be like the, because it's always a hard job, right? So how can we make it like set ourselves up with the best circumstances up at the top of it to make it the most rewarding and worthwhile to do? So those are the things that I look for when I'm starting to like strike out on another project.
Mm. And Jenny, how do you do this? How are you managing all these shows and projects and things? How does it all fit together?
I love switching and I love thinking about new things. Like I just love brainstorming. I really do. And I love story. Like I just have a real love of story. So, you know, it's so exciting getting to go, oh, we're thinking about this now. And then now I'm thinking about this. And oh, okay, now I have to clear out time and get into like I there's just something to me that is very that it's like so exciting and I love writers. I love talking to them about ideas. I love pitching together. I just really get lit up by that whole experience, and then I kind of know if it's something that I have to write, if it's like I just can't imagine not writing it or someone else writing it, if I would be like jealous. And if I'm not jealous, then I feel like I can be a good helper, but somebody else's voice is like the one that needs to be out there kind of creating it. And if I'm like, I can't, I can feel that kind of, it's like bursting to come out, then I have to write it. And that's sort of how I divide. And then same with listening to ideas. If you're like, oh my gosh, if I love that so much, you know, you have to kind of separate. I love that so much and I can do a good job with it, or I love that so much. Am I the best person to do that? Sometimes you have to say, no, someone else is, or you have to check yourself. Oh, like, am I just wanting that because it seems like a big splashy idea and I feel like I'm going to feel like I missed out if somebody else gets it. Like you have to, it has to, yeah. I think, come from like a real artistic inspiration, because you'll never, it's so much time. There's always so much time. And so you don't want to do anything as like a reflex against somebody else, because if somebody like, you know, oh, well, I'd be, you know, it's let somebody else then have it and give it all their passion. But it's passion. It's like you're writing. So it's like, you're, you know, I got to want to like stay up like the time when the whole family's in bed and it's like I get to go to my office.
Yeah.
I feel like a witch, you know, like I got like,
yeah,
I'm just like, it's candles. I've got my like, you know, hoodie on and like no one's talking to me. And like that is like magic time for me.
I love that.
Yeah. And it's, I feel always, always so lucky that, like, I think all of us, I'm sure, do just like that we get to make our living in the arts and we get to do something that we like.
Yeah.
The dream, like, it, you know, it was at some point for all of us a dream that, like, did not have a clear path. You know, it's not like if you, it's very hard, but if you go to med school, chances are you're going to become a doctor, right? If you go to film school, there's no, it, the chances are that you become a working writer are probably just as slim as if you didn't. Mm-hmm. So, like, you got to have the fire.
I used to talk about that when I graduated from USC. Like, there'd be these, like, oh, so-and-so is moving back to Ohio parties. like of the people that were like, I'm not, screw this, this isn't pop. And I was like, I'm not going to those. I'm not, I got to, like, really just focus in on, like, the, I have to live in the inevitability of my desired outcome to be a professional writer. And I can't, like, let in that kind of thinking that's like, or you could just give up and go, like, I really needed to change the way that I, my, you just have to be careful what you think about. Yeah. And I think that, like, then you are so lucky and it happens and you're so excited. And yet, I don't know if it's just like a human nature thing that we can tend to turn anything in our given moment into this, like, narrative of, you know, persecution and conspiracy against us. And even like a, some very highly paid Hollywood writer could be sitting in a room talking about how hard their life is. And it's like, okay, I mean, just alt pitch. You're living the dream. A lot of people would love to be sitting in that chair. You have a very nice house. Like, there's just like a way to look at things and think about things. And that I think is like an ongoing practice that I've learned a lot from Jenny in that way, that I think that she has like a sort of irrepressible instinct to go to the positive place and dwell in solutions and see the upside of stuff. And if you can really cultivate the discipline to be an optimist and be positive, even when people are like, when you're taking fire, you know, then I think maybe you can run a show.
Katie told me I was an optimist. I had no idea.
She was like, no kidding. Is that true? Like, you're like the most optimistic person I know. Like, if somebody was like, Jenny, I'm so sorry, but you have nose cancer. She would be like, you know, what a great time in the world it is to get nose cancer. Medicine has never been more evolved. You know, we're in the best city in the world for, like, nose specialists abound. Like, she would just find for you this way of looking at things that you just are in awe of. And I feel that it is part of her success. Although it's so amazing. Instinctive for you, you don't even know you're doing it. For me, it's a daily active practice to not be like a miserable bastard.
I find that hard to believe.
Well, some days I get it's easier than others, but that's just how it goes, right?
Don't mind me. I'm just literally taking notes on the things that you're both saying because you're perfect. I love this. I love it. I wonder, you know, from these seats, which are pretty high on the ladder that you sit in, that you've worked your way up to, I feel at this point in my career from, you know, my seat that I've worked my way up to, that we're making something that's really special. And we said it earlier, it's grounded in female leadership, but it's for everyone, and everyone watches it and feels good and kind of goes, wow, this feels different. I wonder what it is. And we're all sitting here in our little witch hats going, wah-ha-ha. But I wonder about when you look back and you see the way that women didn't always get to be portrayed on TV. I think about that a lot from my early career, even when you look forward from this to where we'll take this show and where you want to go with other things, are there things you're conscientiously considering or consciously thinking about in terms of ways that you hope we as women get to be not only portrayed on camera, but in leadership roles and treated behind the camera?
Go ahead, Jenny.
Well, I just think, you know, allowing the wide range of female experiences to be shown, seen, and, you know, that is empowering. So the more examples of female leadership means that each example does not have to be the example, you know? And I think just, I think always being conscious of, like, what you're putting on screen is really important. That, like, nothing, don't let anything just, like, kind of happen. And I really like to, like, everything's a choice. Because I think then those are the things that you don't notice, but suddenly you're looking around and you're realizing, oh, the makeup of the extras is not this one thing. It's this other thing, or this is the environment that we're putting in, or this person is looking to this other person with respect. Like, you're always kind of modeling things, I think, in TV. And by not letting anything just be, just happen, you can make sure that the image that you're putting on, because you have your small corner of the room, of the world in which you can exert what kind of you believe and what influence you have and what's important to you. And just like making sure that everything is a choice on a show, I think is really the thing I try to just constantly remind myself and makes me feel like the work that we do is also important beyond the words that they say, but like, what are people seeing and what are we modeling and putting out in the world in terms of like how we want the world to be?
I mean, I think that we really just, the more specific and like the more detail and specificity each character has, the better the storytelling is in general. And also, I think the more impact it can have in this larger question, right? Of like, what kind of female stories can we tell? What kind of stories in general can we tell? And what are we just sort of saying in the world normal can be, right? That, that there's something very subversive to just writing very fully formed, complex characters who are all the things. Right. Mm. And I learned that on Resilient Isles for the first time, that like Sasha Alexander pointed out to me, that it was like really outrageous to have this show with these two female leads who are excellent at their jobs and friends. And that's it. Not trying to steal each other's man, not trying to take each other down, not having some kind, just that was really so outrageous and audacious. For 7 seasons of a television show to just have these two, this woman is a really good medical examiner and this woman's a really good detective, and they're going to just like help each other solve crimes. And from her point of view, she felt like that was her, like a, you know, we were contributing to a conversation about what can be possible in terms of how we understand the way women relate to each other professionally and personally, and how that can be dramatic and compelling without going to maybe some more stereotypical places that might have been more familiar terrain in the past. And so that was like an eye-opening thing for me, that why that was a meaningful character for her to play and why it was important for her. And I really saw that as an opportunity then. And writing that character and those stories, I took like a lot of, I felt like a responsibility to carry that banner and to keep doing that with every character, with every character and every story. Like Jenny's saying, those choices, they resonate in a larger way.
Mm. I love that so much. I just love the way that you guys answer questions. They're always unexpected and far more inspiring than anyone who I've heard answer them before. It's been deeply inspiring to hang with you both, which is wild because I'm always inspired when I hang with you both. And I'm still just learning so much from you both, including about your stories today, which is my favorite. I'm wondering, you know, industry future aside, the representation of women aside, all the stuff we've been talking about that's coming down the pike, I really wonder just personally for each of you, when you look forward from this vantage point, what feels like your work in progress right now? What's that lies ahead?
You know, I've got kids moving towards middle school. Mm-hmm. So that is really the, for me, like just remembering middle school, understanding like some of my own things that were hard and difficult. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's bringing up a lot, and it's just, I feel that I have to learn how to parent in this moment, these kids in this pandemic to me, that's the biggest work in progress of my life, how to really help guide without hovering, how to instill self-esteem while honoring anxieties and insecurities, like just all of that I think, you know, when I look back so many of the things that I struggle with and still try to work on for myself today are so rooted in the sort of adolescent experience. I'm like looking at it again through the lens of a parent is very daunting and inspiring, and feels like really something that I'm going to have to be flexible about and patient with, both for the kids and with myself.
I agree with all that. I hear all that. Yeah, I think I tell myself, like, this moment right now of life is about, like, I just keep thinking, if I just, I hope I can keep doing this longer, because I don't feel that it will ever get easier, you know, but I think I will benefit from doing it more. It's just one of those things. And I, by which I mean, like, both running this show and being a writer and being in this family and being a partner to my husband, like, all of it feels like, gosh, you just really learn it on the job. It's all on the job training. And so I just want to keep at it, because I'm just trying to, like, really synthesize these experiences. And then when I come back around to this bend one more time, I'll benefit from that and be maybe just a little farther, you know, along in terms of how I can show up for people and how I can handle things and say, oh, I know, I remember, this is like that thing where, you know, it's kind of like, you just have that own recognition of yourself in a different moment in time, but having a similar experience and having that, seeing that as an opportunity to do a little better, or just at least have a little more insight. So yeah, just for me, I'm just trying to, like, evolve as fast as I can.
Casual.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, like, you know, just evolution. Maybe we could, yeah, you know, kind of on a deadline, just ever so slightly faster.
Mm-hmm. I think about that sometimes when I look at Charlize Theron. I'm like, whatever brand of neo-human she is, I would like to be that. I would like some of that DNA. How does it work?
Yeah. Like, how do some people just seem like they get more input in the packet at the start?
Sophia.
I mean, Katie, you...
Yeah, Sophia has it.
You have it.
Sophia, come on.
The most evolved person that I know. You just know so much about so much. It's incredible. And you're so thoughtful about so many things, and the way that you look at things and the questions that you ask. I find that so inspiring on the day to day, just like all the things that you know and all the ways that you deeply engage with things. You know, I know a lot of people who know a little bit about a lot. I don't know many people who know a lot about a lot, and you're one of them. And it's really inspiring. Like, I want more of that.
Oh my God. Thanks, guys. Just so you know, I'm usually walking around going, what am I doing? What is going on? What? That's probably the reason I ask so many questions, because I don't feel like I know. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's the whole reason I started this show. I was like, I just want to ask people stuff. So here we are. Thank you so much for coming on today. I just really love and admire the both of you. And I pinch myself every single day that I get to go to work and work for human beings like you. It's incredible.
Me too. Awesome. Same. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sophia.
Thank you.